The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So as some of you can see, we have the LGBTQ flag up here on the altar next to the Buddha today. Today being the one-year anniversary of the 49 people who were killed in the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. 53 people were wounded. It's been said, I think, to have been the biggest mass killing by a single person in United States history. So, I always believe that what we do here, you have trouble hearing it out there? It's not happening out there. I wonder if someone knows where the volume button is out there, could check it. No one knows where the volume button is? So let's see, is that happening now? So what I was saying is that it's my kind of one of my deepest wishes or hopes that the practice that we do here, the teachings we do here, are for the welfare of our world. And part of that wish is that, or in recognition, is that there's a need to be a witness to what goes on in the world and to really take it in and be affected by it. And to, to those of us who were paying attention a year ago, it was quite painful to learn about what happened there in Orlando. So as I teach about what I talk about today, I'd like to dedicate it to all the victims of Orlando, and in some ways we have all been victims of it, but especially the LGBTQ community, who've had so much challenges over this last year. The amount of violence and hostility against the LGBTQ community seems to have gone up dramatically in the last year. At least from the reports of friends of mine who are LGBTQ and the experiences they're having in places that I never would have thought, here in the in Bay Area, where I never thought there would have been problems. So, so what I'd like to talk about is that a distinction I think is sometimes useful between what we do and how we do it. And that many people search for a life of what, as if the thing that they're going to do. And some people find that what is not that important for them, but it's more important how they do it. And I would like to propose that as people get more connected, more in touch with themselves in a deep inner way, what we do might still be important, but what grows in importance more and more is how we do it, how we go about our life, how we live, how we approach what we do. And that the means, the end does not justify the means for someone who is practicing mindfulness. That somehow these have to be in harmony, that we don't do things which are harmful in order to have positive results, good results. And so the idea of increasing sense, as we come into the present moment more and more, more sensitive and aware of what's going on for ourselves and the world immediately around us, the how becomes more and more important. And as I said, it doesn't preclude having a what we do, but it has a lot to do with how we do it. And the how we do it can be done with real intention. It can really kind of, we can have really clear intention for why we do it, a clear motivation that's quite empowering, something we can dedicate and devote our life to in big ways. So much so that some people talk about being resolved. We can be resolved to do something. And some people have a very strong resolve. They don't just simply have an intention. Their intention is behind them a tremendous strength. that they're going to do it. And Bhagavan becomes maybe more important than almost anything else. This is what we're going to do. Some people struggle with the idea of intention. They might have all kinds of great things they'd like to do, but then the follow-through is hard. It's hard to get around to it or pick it up, or there's inhibition or there's fear or there's other things that are distracting. But to really kind of discover some strength behind what we want to do with our lives is one of the tasks of a lot of people. And it's part of this how we do it, to do it with strength, dedication, devotion. In the teachings of the Buddha, there's a teaching about the four resolves. And these four resolves is how it's often translated into English, the word resolve. They can also be translated as determination. But the Pali word means something like to take a stand, adhitana, to take a higher stand. That's I understand that, you know, to really, you know, take a stand where you stand, what you're going to do. And the Buddha said there are four resolves, four places we can stand. And this is very interesting. He talks about this, you know, this place to stand, when he also teaches that things are constantly changing and in flux. There's a kind of way in which we understand not to cling to anything, not to hold on to anything, not to grasp, not to crave. But if we don't cling and don't crave, what do we base our life on? Where do we rest our life? What do we dedicate ourselves to? And so these four resolves might not be the final goal of how we live our lives, but for the they can be a lot to do with how we do whatever we do. But they can also be resolves that are reliable. You know, to know what is really important, what should I do in this life, is a big question. And these four resolves of the Buddha, I think, are very significant, very powerful resolves that have a kind of universality. I think they're probably relevant for almost everyone, and not just relevant as a minor thing to do, but something really to dedicate a life to. So these four resolves are the resolve for wisdom, the resolve for truth, the resolve for, it's a wonderful word called chaga, which for now I'll just say it means relinquishment, and then to be resolved on peace. So to have these four qualities as part of what we do, the how we do, to do whatever we do with wisdom, to do it with a devotion towards truth, to do it with not with the idea of acquisition, but the idea of a certain kind of healthy and wise relinquishment as we do it. And then to do it with a sense of peace. And the last one in particular is very interesting, because often the final goal of Buddhist practice is peace, to have deep, abiding sense of inner peace, well-being within ourselves, the heart at peace with itself, in a way that is very refreshing, nourishing, satisfying. It feels like this is really kind of, you've finally arrived in a place that feels kind of like eternally satisfying, because there's no agitation, no discomforts in which to try to get relief for. And if you don't need relief, it's pretty good. And so what's nice about peace is that the search for peace, the quest for peace, can be a peaceful quest. And so the how we are can be reflected in the goal of peace, to be peaceful to the best of our ability as we go approach this. Now these four resolves then are, so the first one is, you know, that seems like a big deal, wisdom. Maybe I have to write it. Now people think maybe they're supposed to read a lot of books and try to get a lot of knowledge and understanding. But the wisdom of the Buddha is something that is much more immediate, and something that we can kind of use as a guide for our lives. And one of the definitions of wisdom, or of a wise person by the Buddha, a wise person is someone who intends for the welfare of themselves, for the welfare of others, and for the welfare of self and others. And this idea of self and others is an interesting category. I take it to be the we. There's you, there's me, there's you, and there's we, as a community, as a combination, as a, you know, as a collective. In the one place, the Buddha says this last category, instead of saying intends the welfare for self and other, he says in the same place, he says, one intends the welfare for the whole world. It's pretty cool, right? That should be in your heart. So to be resolved, to be wise, is to be interested and concerned with what brings welfare, well-being, to oneself and to others and to everyone else. And what's nice about this, it's not singling out one of those categories, that it's all about my welfare, forget everyone else. Or it's all about someone else's welfare and I don't count. Or it's not a about sacrificing everything for the whole world, there's a social welfare, but there's somehow those three are held kind of in equal status. And maybe by taking care of all three, we take care of each one. Or, you know, it is together, it's kind of the healthiest kind of way. So to have this be the definition of being wise is kind of a, you know, how are you wise then? It starts by having that intention to care for the welfare of others. And it comes with pursuing it or being interested in finding out what is welfare. And it can be said that all of Buddhism is dedicated to the welfare, the well-being of human beings in all forms, for oneself, for the other, and for our society as a whole. And the resolve on truth is interesting because, you know, certainly it's good to be resolved on speaking the truth, but there should be no buts. I mean, that's a great thing. And in addition, there's also being resolved to be connected to what is true. What can we rely on, really? What is really true here? And there's a variety of things that the Buddha points to as being true. The word that's translated as true, satya, can also mean real. What is real? So what is real in our world? Is the pursuit of money and wealth and status a real thing? Is having you know, lots of recreational opportunities, is that somehow the truth, or is that real in some solid way? Are fantasies and pleasures, sensual pleasures, are they true? Are they real in some way that's really reliable, like something you can rely on? Can you rely on sensual pleasure? Can you rely on comfort? What can you rely on? And so the Buddha points to a few different things, but I want to point to the one he says, and when he gives us specific teachings about these four resolves, I want to mention the one that he highlights. And he highlights something that I like to translate as release. Sometimes called liberation. It's vimoccha and vimutti. This to release. To liberation, and he takes liberation as being the highest truth, the highest thing that is real. That is real, he says. And so, what is it about liberation that makes it true? And you know, the highest truth is an interesting topic, interesting question. And what I'd like to propose as an answer to that question is that. That what the release or the freedom that Buddhism points to is only relevant if we're not free. And if we release whatever keeps us unfree, that experience of release is not a thing. It's not something that comes and goes in the same way as clouds come and go, or people come and go, or thoughts and emotions come and go. The experience of it might come and go in a certain way, but it's not a thing. And to take as the highest truth or the highest thing that's real, something which is not kind of not real, but maybe more important than anything that's real, kind of. So I know this is confusing, probably what I'm saying. So take, if you spent your lifetime with your fist held tight, you can't do a lot of things with if you always keep your hand in a fist. You can do some things, but most people will step away if you go around this way. You know, it's not really a friendly thing to do. But, you know, you can do some things with it. And if you really clench it for a long time, then, if all you do that, it begins hurting, you know, and tight and restricted. If at some point someone tells you, you know, you don't have to be this way, you can open your hand. And you say, oh, really? So you open your hand, and lo and behold, it's a relief. Lo and behold, now the hands are open. So you've released the grip of the hand, and what you have now is an open hand. The openness is not a thing that exists as an existent thing. You can't touch the openness. But the openness is very meaningful for someone who had their hand closed all the time. If you're indoors all the time, and you never, you know, maybe in, you know, in jail, and finally the doors are open, that openness is really meaningful, and you can walk out. But the openness doesn't exist as a thing. It exists as an absence. But that absence is quite significant. So the experience of release, of freedom, involves a radical, dramatic absence of clinging, of craving, of hate, of delusion. And it doesn't really leave you something that exists. But you can't say it doesn't exist. You can't quite say that the openness, open door, the openness, open space in the door doesn't exist in the conventional way of how things exist. But you can't say it doesn't exist. And the Buddha said, so when Buddha says the highest truth is release, could he be saying that, you know, that's reliable because that's always there? In a way that everything else that kind of is a thing comes and goes and you can't quite rely on. So I hope you followed that. And part of the movement in Buddhism is to move towards greater and greater release. And that in turn informs us, guides us for how to be wise. Because as people get let go more and more of how they cling, then they understand what it feels like to suffer less and feel happier, more peaceful. And then we understand what welfare is for people. And so that guides us to understand how to live for the welfare of self and others. The third resolve is the resolve on relinquishment. And it's a wonderful word because the word chaga also means generosity. And it kind of shows the richness of the word relinquishment when it's also used to describe to be generous. Generous is a nice thing. Perhaps relinquishment is as warm-hearted as a movement as generosity. Because it makes sense, you know, if you give something to someone, you're kind of relinquishing it for the benefit of someone else. So this idea of not just letting go, but kind of handing it up or giving it up. In some nice way. But so as we have a sense, greater and greater sense of release, of freedom, then it makes sense to appreciate how valuable it is to continue that process of release, of relinquishment. And how I understand the word relinquishment here is not just letting go, but it comes from a clear decision, a resolve that there's something that you no longer want to be holding on to and clinging to. So it's a decisive letting go. It's letting go with wisdom, with understanding. I'm no longer interested in this. I'm no longer going to do this anymore. And I wonder if all of you maybe have some reference point like this in the course of your lifetime, where there was something that you did over and over again, repeatedly, and at some point you say, I think I'm done with this. This is it's run its course. This is no longer serving me. this is harmful for me. And I'm not only am I going to let it go, but I'm clearly making a decision. No more of this. I'm going to stop this. Someone I knew a long time ago who was smoking cigarettes a lot, he ran out of cigarettes at 11 or 12 o'clock at night. So he had to go to the store to get cigarettes because he had to smoke. And on his way there in the dark, he said, "What am I doing? This is crazy to have to feel I have to have this a cigarette this time of night." And he made a decision there and then to stop smoking cigarettes. He relinquished cigarettes. He thought it was for his own welfare. So this idea of relinquishment is something decisive, that there's some kind of powerful statement or powerful act we can do. The English word renunciation also speaks to this idea of doing something, letting go with decision, letting go with kind of in a clear, declared way. Because it means literally, the renunciation, as I understand it in Latin, means to announce again, to state again. And so, it's kind of like, I'm clearly going to do this. I don't stand behind this anymore. I'm not interested in this anymore. And how can we do this in a way that's generous for ourselves, generous for others, generous for the world? And then the last resolve is the resolve on peace. And peace might seem kind of boring, might seem, kind of dull or, kind of not so interesting when there's so many exciting things to do and big things to accomplish and all that. But I think that if we discover how to be peaceful, we discover a real peace, meaning we're no longer in conflict with ourselves. We're no longer arguing with ourselves in the world. We're no longer in conflict with ourselves, in conflict with others, and in conflict with the world with reality. That's pretty wonderful, to not be in conflict. Then people will protest when they hear this. Well, people are in conflict with me. They can't avoid conflict. The Buddha once said, others are in conflict with me. I'm not in conflict with them. That's an interesting statement. How can that be true? I think we often identify so strongly with someone's angry with us. That means that now we're involved in the anger, we're in conflict. But do we have to participate in a way where we feel like we're in conflict? I think it's possible to participate and resolve challenges we have when other people are in conflict with us without us feeling that we are in conflict in return. Meaning that we're not contracted, we're not asserting ourselves, we're not fighting, we're not hitting. Conflict means, literally in Latin, means to strike out. So this idea of being at peace, I think is a profound thing. One of the formative experiences in my life for starting a spiritual practice was walking into, when I was 18, I walked into a small, 1,000-year-old chapel in France, stone, kind of big stone blocks. And the chapel was probably about maybe 10 by 10, the size of it, 10 by 12, so it was pretty small. And I stepped into it, and immediately there was peace. There was this amazing experience of peace that seemed to descend and move through my body. And I lingered there as long as I could before I was ushered out to experience that. In this teaching the Buddha gave about the four resolves, he said that if someone has these four resolves and somehow matures into them, they become a sage at peace. The sage at peace. And then he went on to say, a sage at peace is no longer swept away by the tides of conceiving. kind of evocative word, the tides of conceiving, the currents, the floods of conceiving. And this word conceiving is very interesting in English, because conceiving, the way it's being used here, it's used as a way of thinking about things. And the Pali word means to imagine. But conceiving in English also means to give birth to something, to conceive some, you know, a child. And so this idea of giving birth to all kinds of things through our thoughts. We live in our thoughts, we conceive, we live in our imagination. And to really experience the peace the Buddha is teaching about means that we're no longer living in our imagination. We're no longer imagining, living in imaginary futures, imaginary pasts. We're no longer living in the imaginations of who we think we need to be, who we are, the conceivings through which we end up in conflict with ourselves, the conceivings in which we are critical of ourselves, the ideas that we live by, the comparative thinking we have. The world of conceiving, the world of our imaginary thoughts, our creative kind of thinking we live in under, is too often not a kind world, not a place that's conducive to living in a harmonious way in this world. So the Buddha talked about a sage at peace who has stopped all conceiving. And in particular, he pointed to conceiving all kinds of identities that we live under, all kinds of ideas of who we are. Me, myself, and mine. I am this, I am that, I will be, I shall be, I was. All this idea of swirling currents and rivers and tides of self-conception and self-concern and being apologetic or being defensive or building ourselves up, or, you know, all this complicated world is not a world of peace. And what does it take to stop all the agitation, all the preoccupation with self, so that that agitation settles and we experience peace? The Buddha then went on and said something that is a little bit provocative, a little bit mystical. It sounds mystical, perhaps. And he said, for the sage at peace, who has no conceivings, no, it doesn't live in the imagination of the mind, for that person, there is no birth, no aging, and no death. That's a kind of interesting statement. I can't imagine the Buddha meant that sage is never going to get old and never going to die. I can't mean that. So it must mean something else. It must be something peculiar. What does it mean to say that someone no longer is born, no longer ages, and no longer dies? For people who are worried about dying, people who are worried about getting old, this is kind of like, you know, should be a very curious thing. Here the Buddha perhaps has finally figured out the formula for immortality. So I don't know, I'll try to explain a little bit what I think he means by this. And that is that to live in the world of ideas of birth and aging and death, we're living in the world of our thoughts and our ideas. And the question is, are we going to allow our thoughts and the ideas of our mind be the source of our happiness or unhappiness? Are we going to let the swirling conceptions, the imaginations, the abstractions, the ideas we have be what kind of really, that we are we going to rely on that, those, for our welfare or for the solution for our life? And there's something unreliable about a high percentage of what people think. So I don't know any of you well enough to know, you know, if it's true for you, but I think that, you know, like for me, if I was going to kind of put a statistical number on the number of seriously reliable thoughts that I have, thoughts that I should base my life on, and this is the truth, and everyone else should obey, and you know, just go along. I think my success rate for that is probably pretty low. You know, if I'm generous to myself, maybe 2% of my thoughts are really kind of, you know, something worthwhile. But if people look at their own thoughts in their minds and look at what percent of the thoughts do they say to themselves or think about that causes harm, that hurts, ow. I'm no good, I'm lousy, I'm not up to it. You know, that person must hate me, or all kinds of ideas that hurt, that have an ouch in them. I suspect that it's a lot more than 2% that people have. The way I talk to a lot of people about their lives, and I would guess that for some of the people I talk to, a majority of their thoughts are hurt in some way or other. And those thoughts are conceivings and ideas. And it is possible to stop relying on those thoughts, to stop basing one's life in those conceivings, and to rely on something else. And so the Buddha offered four things that you can rely on. You can maybe switch your allegiance from these painful self-inflicting thoughts, ideas, to beginning to focus on the resolve on wisdom, the resolve on truth. What's really true here? Resolve on relinquishment, or maybe generosity, and the resolve on peace. And if there's peace in the mind, and the mind is not caught up in its contractions and tightness and agitation, it's not going to base its welfare on these thoughts. And if our welfare and well-being and understanding of the world is not rooted or dependent on the world of concepts and ideas and conceivings, then some of our conceivings will begin to recede and maybe not be there. And at some point, we realize that the ideas of aging and death that we live with are mostly just ideas. They might have some relationship to what's happening over time in our lives. We don't deny that there's aging and death, but it's not necessary to live with those ideas. In fact, many of these ideas that we live in belong kind of to a virtual reality that we give more substance and weight to than reality itself. And sometimes these conceivings that we think are so important, that we it's kind of like taking a paintbrush and watercolors and trying to paint a picture on running water. That's how successful these thoughts are sometimes. As soon as they're said, they really kind of fade away. Or I think actually a better metaphor would be, or analogy would be, taking the paintbrush and the watercolors and trying to paint in the space of the open door. It doesn't even take. There's something about the nature of these thoughts and ideas that we grasp onto or that grab hold of us, that when we release their grip and we can see directly, feel, be directly, we experience ourselves independent of our thoughts. Independent of the ideas and judgments and criticisms and conflicts that we might swirl around in our thoughts. Who are you when you don't use thoughts to tell you? Who are you when you don't use thoughts to answer the question? Are you then, just in trying to feel your way into that, does that kind of push aside or drop away some of the usual ideations that you live in and swirl in and concerned with? Who are you when you don't use thoughts to tell you? I knew a man who in the 1980s was dying of AIDS. He was a Zen priest, Isan Dorsey, he was dying, and he would tell people with great enthusiasm to have AIDS is to be alive. And for him, as I understood it, he was not focusing on dying. For him, dying was an abstraction. He knew he was going to die, but that's not where he lived in those ideas and thoughts. He lived in being alive, here. And I've known people as they die, so many of the ideas and concepts that they live in over the course of their life no longer seem to hold them and grab them. Their fears and concerns and projections and remembrances, and this stuff begins to fall away. Maybe they're relinquished, and they're left with the simplicity, the pristine simplicity of this moment here. And if you've ever visited someone as they're dying, or visit someone right after a death, they're dead. And if you had the occasion not to be grieving at that moment, I think there's something about the simplicity of those moments that can be quite powerful, because it's kind of like that suddenly all these concepts and ideas that we live in have been stilled and quieted. And it can be pristine, this moment, the purity of the moment, the emptiness, the clarity of the moment, just by itself, almost as if this is enough. Here is real peace. Here is the clearing of the clouds, clearing of the fog living in, of ideas and thoughts and preoccupations. Here things are simple. So for a sage at peace to have no birth, aging, and death means that that person has a sense of aliveness, of connectedness, of freedom here and now that is unfiltered or uncovered, that's not kind of covered over by the projections or the ideas and concepts that we often live in our life by. And what does it take to discover that peace? What does it take to discover that experience of being alive where our preoccupations have been put to rest? And so we have these four resolves. And I think these four resolves are great resolves for how to live a life. And almost any healthy endeavor that you want to do in your life bringing along these four resolves and how you do it. But also, if we're resolved on these four things, those are also a path to genuine freedom. So to be resolved on wisdom, which I think as the way I talked about it, is almost synonymous to being resolved on compassion. Or living a life, making decisions of how to live a life that are compassionate, concerned for the welfare of self and other and the whole world. To be resolved on truth, to be truthful, to be a true person. To know who you are honestly and fully enough that you can be true to who you are. To be resolved on relinquishment, perhaps generosity. And to be resolved on peace. The kind of peace that, for me, is associated with the early dawn. The light is coming up and I'm sitting on the edge of a vast body of water, a lake or bay, and the water is completely still and flat and spreads out, and the light is there, and no one's up yet. Maybe the animals and birds haven't gotten up yet, and it's just this wonderful stillness and quiet, tranquility, looking out across the lake, and all things are good, all things are fine. There's no birth, no aging, and no death for those few minutes before everyone else gets up. So, four resolves. So I offer them to you this evening as something you can reflect on. Maybe there's something that one of them, or two, or three, or all four of them might be something to consider. Not only are they useful to maybe live a little bit with those resolves, those intentions, but also use them as a way of questioning in a healthy, kind way, compassionate way, questioning and looking at what are some of the other things that you're resolved on that you had never really realized you resolved on, that maybe you don't want to be resolved on, and maybe you'd like to substitute one of these four great resolves of the Buddha. Thank you.